Says at this time the chairperson should qualify briefly. Requirements for chairing a meeting at the Central Orlando Group Saturday night speakers meeting are 1 year of continuous sobriety, have Central as your home group, and attend a group conscious meeting. My name is Chuck and I'm an alcoholic. I do meet those minimum requirements. You know, it's really funny to be standing up here for me tonight, because when I got here 14 months ago, I remember, you know, coming to my first few speaker meetings and looking at the person standing up at the podium, thinking that it just wasn't an attainable goal to even stay sober long enough to do this, you know, and it is. Obviously, here I'm living proof today that this program works, and so are many other men and women in this room. I got to say, you know, I came in a suicidal dark mess when I arrived at AA. Didn't have any friends to speak of. I didn't have a life. I didn't have a connection to God at all. You know, I lost my mother to this disease at the age of 57 as a direct result of alcoholism, and I'm losing my father to it, cirrhosis of the liver, multiple conditions, 66 years old, you know. I don't, you know, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. Any doubts that I have are squashed at this point. You know, I'm losing or lost both my parents to this disease. We're not a glum lot. This is a lot of fun. I love the fellowship. I love being a part of everything that happens here. But I take this very seriously. This disease kills. And if you're new or just coming back, please stay. Please see someone after the meeting if you're embarrassed to identify yourself, because we want you here. Thanks. Okay, the group has asked me to remind you to please make sure your phones are off and to refrain from walking around or talking while the speaker is sharing. Now I'm to introduce the speaker. I met Ed about a year ago when I first got here, and I could go on about the things that I like about Ed and the things that impress me. One of the things that I've learned in this program one of the most important things is caring about other people. And no matter what kind of day Ed has had, no matter what is going on in his life, and he's had some personal struggles like a lot of us, his main concern is what's going on in your life and what's happening to you. He doesn't dwell on what his problems are, and it's almost hard to get him to talk about himself, you know. So I'm really curious to hear his story tonight, and without any further ado,
I'll tell you not.
I give you Ed.
Hi, I'm Ed. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm going to record this. And the new iPhone software has been updated. We'll see if I can get it to work properly. Joe, you did a great job. Social anxiety, I hope I do as good as you did. Everybody that's new here that said that you're in your first 30 days are coming back, that took a lot of courage. I absolutely could not do that. So when I came into the rooms in 1995, I was really lucky it stuck with me. I never relapsed immediately after that. I didn't have any issues. I was able to continue to come back over and over again. And I, never mind. This is a family show. I'm going to keep everything so clean tonight. It's not even funny. So I came in 1995. And had 12 years of sobriety, and then I lost it, and I lost it bad. And I see a couple people in here tonight that know me when that happened, and it was catastrophic, just like it is for anybody. But after I did that, I could stay sober for about 4 or 5 months, and then I understood what it was like to not be able to stay sober and to come back over and over and over again. Because I will tell you, I was judgmental when I first came in 95. I'd say to myself, why can't you just stop drinking? I did, you know, I didn't relapse, it was fine. You know, just put down the drink, blah, 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 blah. Well, after I relapsed and that happened to me, I was like, I get it now. I can't stop. This is something I can't control. So I'm gonna tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And this past year has been really rough for me. But before I get into all those happy details, just to give you a little bit of background, I was born in upstate New York. My mom has multiple sclerosis. She was diagnosed when she was 16, so she's had it my entire life. She had me when she was 19. My parents have been together the entire time. This year they're going to celebrate 50 years of being married. My dad changes her diapers every day, gives her her medication 4 times a day, and brushes her teeth every single day, and he's done that for the past 30 years. I used to hate my father. I used to think he was lazy, and I used to think that he was mean, and I despised him because he didn't like me. Now I think he is absolutely amazing. Anybody that can stick with somebody for 30 years and do that, I can't even imagine. There's days I don't want to take a shower, you know. I see people that have children, you know, and I've never had kids, but I can imagine that, you know, some days if you got a migraine or something, you kind of bear through it, but you can get your kids off to school, or maybe you can ask somebody to help you or whatever. But when my dad doesn't feel good, there is nobody to change my mom's diapers or to do any of that kind of stuff. And I would love to aspire to that, but I'll tell you, I don't know if I could, because I'm kind of lazy. This is a great program, and I try to do it to the best of my ability, but there's things and obstacles that step in my way all the time. When I was little, I was born with an eye disease called amblyopia, which is a big word for somebody like me. And basically all it is you have a lazy eye. My eye turned into my nose. And my parents would take me everywhere to try to get this taken care of. And back, you know, I'm a little bit older, so back then we would go all over the place and do stuff to seek doctors for this. And it was a real disappointment to my dad because he wanted a little boy that could play ball, he could play ball with, and that he could play catch with and be proud of. And instead, everywhere we went, I had a patch on my eye. And I wore a patch on and off my eyes for 5 years. And so everywhere we went, we had that stigma. And they'd always go, "What's wrong with your little boy?" And I was one of these little kids that learned how to talk really early. And I also, have you ever seen the little kids, you call them, you look at the kid and you're like, wow, that's a little man. That's a little woman. You know, they're just adult. And they're like 4 years old. Well, that's what I was, you know. And I never talked like a kid. I just talked like an adult from the beginning. And people would go, "What's wrong with your son?" And my mom would go, "Tell him, Eddie." And I'd go, "I had amblyopia." And they'd be like, "Okay." And they're like, "Whoa." You know, we're getting away from him. I don't know what that meant. And he enunciated it a little too clearly. So that was just the beginning of everything, you know. From a young age, I realized I was gay. I'm not going to get into specifics with that. I don't want to offend anybody if it's not something you agree with or don't agree with, and it doesn't matter. The thing that I would want you to hear in my story is that I hope you can get something from me about the loneliness and the isolation that I felt growing up as a child, regardless of my sexuality or who I hung around with or what was wrong with my parents or anything like that, because it doesn't matter. I think the thing that we all struggle with, or I hope you can identify, is the loneliness is the most incapacitating thing for me in this disease, more than anything. It takes over everything. It was the reason that I drank. I never felt part of. As a little kid, I'd always hear my dad going, "Don't act like a little girl, don't act like a little girl." You know, I used to like to sing, and they would get upset when when my voice started to change and I figured out I could sing in falsetto. My mother would get so pissed off. She'd be like, "Don't sing like a girl," you know. And so, you know, it's funny now, but you know, that kind of stuff really, it impacts children. It impacts them big time. And I refused to sing after that. And I was in my 40s before I started singing. And I do it as a hobby now, but I've recorded 2 CDs, and they're halfway decent. They're not bad, but it's something that I always enjoyed. You never have any idea how you're impacting somebody. You never have any idea how you're impacting somebody. And I always felt so alone and so a part of, and got teased unmercifully in high school, absolutely unmercifully in high school. That was Lake County 20, 30 years ago. And back then, you know, the guys would all come to school with guns in the gun rack in the back of their pickup. Of course, now there's metal detectors at those same schools that I went to, you know, so times have changed. But I was teased unmercifully. They would call me names that I didn't even know what they were and didn't even understand, and they knew what I was before I knew what I was. And it, you know, I see things in the news now, like with bullying and stuff like that, and it just, you know, thank God I wasn't drinking then, because I would be dead, because I wanted to die then. I hadn't even started drinking yet. I was in high school, and I wanted to die because of people calling me names and me never feeling a part of. And I was on the chunky side in high school, and I couldn't stand that. I'd isolate and just, I don't know why I had this big thing. I would always hide myself in my room and make a pot of orange herbal tea with a whole cup of sugar in it, and eat jalapeno peppers while I watched TV, and I'd lock myself in my room. I don't know what was going on with that, but that was just something that I did. I don't, you know, I don't have any reason for it, but that's what I did, and it sticks in my mind, and that just makes me think, yeah, maybe a little touched. So the isolation carried over from being teased at school to going into my room and locking myself in there, and I couldn't take it anymore. And I didn't have the courage to kill myself, but I knew that I wanted to die. I didn't want to be alive anymore. Between my junior and my senior year, I decided to lose weight, and I did it the most unhealthy way you possibly can. I just fasted, and I remember my personal goal was 32 days with no solid food. And I remember one time I was at work. I used to work in the shoe department at Belk Lindsay in the 11th grade, and I was like 28 days into fasting, and I looked up like this, and my tie cut the blood off right here, just from my tie, from not eating for 20, 30 days, and I almost passed out. I was like, okay, I got to eat something now. So I lost 60 pounds over the summer. It took about three months. When I went back to school, all of a sudden I became popular. They all thought I was my brother. They were like, do you know Ed? And I'm like, I am Ed. And they're like, what? And then I started drinking. And oh my God, I found it. I found it. I found it. The anxiety was gone. It was absolutely gone. I put that stuff in my mouth, and I was like, this is the best thing I've ever put in my mouth before. And I have put a lot of things in my mouth. Oh, come on. Donuts, coffee, caffeine. I'm sorry, I didn't realize what I said. There's something to drink here, right? Okay, so what was I talking about? Alcohol, anxiety. Anxiety was gone. It was gone. It was absolutely gone. Everybody was like, man, you're so funny. You're so funny. Because I have a little bit of a sarcastic sense of humor. And Calvin, I hear you giggling. Shut up, please. And back then, though, you know, my sarcastic sense of humor now is kind of funny. But back then, it was biting, and it was to the core, and it cut you to the quick. And that was my defense mechanism. I did that to protect myself. But when I was drunk, it came across really funny to people. So I had become popular. I lost weight. I learned how to drink. And the thing was, I always promised myself I would never drink because my Aunt June was a drinker. She ended up dying in her late 50s. And all I can remember ever since I was little was Aunt June's drunk again, Aunt June's drunk again. And she'd always go to AA. We'd always hear about AA. I heard about AA ever since I was a little kid. And I'd always hear about her sponsor, Ruby. I don't know who Ruby was, but we heard about Ruby all the time. Never met the woman, never heard anything about her. But, you know, and then there was some Kenny Rogers song named Ruby, and all I ever thought about was someone with big red hair from Atlanta, you know. So the thing is that my aunt was in AA, but she was never in AA. Now that I've been in it for a while, I never remember her doing a fourth step, talking about steps, working with other people, you know, making amends to the family, not that I wanted any of that. You know, it never heard it. So I was never exposed to AA, like I should say, properly, you know? So I'm learning all this stuff and how to drink and all this great stuff, and I'm realizing my sexuality, and I'm still feeling alone and a part of and everything. And I could never get the courage to kill myself, but man, I could do some stuff when I was drinking that was unbelievable, you know? Just wanting attention. I can remember one time just doing 60 down the highway, and I thought, I'm just going to drive right through this ditch. And I just flew right off the road through the ditch and up the side, and these four cars all pulled over, and my best friend was behind me, and they're like, you better get him home, you know? And I must have been pulled over a gazillion times. I am so lucky I never killed anybody. I am so incredibly lucky. I've heard of people in this program that's happened to before. Having that kind of an emotional scar or something, I don't know if I could actually handle. Because I'm a delicate wallflower, and it would just, you know, rip me to shreds. I got four DUIs. Would always take them to court and get them reduced to reckless driving. And that was the 80s, so it was a little bit different then. Now you get, you know, I think on your first offense, your license is automatically gone for a year, and you go to jail for 30 days. I'm not even sure. I'm kind of glad I'm not sure. I don't have to worry about that anymore. Personally, after being in here, my personal opinion is I think that's too harsh. For somebody like on a first offense. And the reason is because I see these people that have children and families, and all of a sudden they have no transportation and they can't take care of their kids, and it impacts so many more people than that. I mean, I understand continual offenses or something, but, and that's just my opinion. There could be somebody in here from MAD that doesn't agree with me, and I appreciate your stance on that, but that's just the way that I feel. It's like, now that I'm in this program, especially this past year, I've gone off into other programs too. I know that probably is shocking to people that I'm in other programs besides this one, and that I'm also in therapy. That's probably also shocking. And my therapist says that most people that are in a 12-step program are usually cross-addicted, and that they have much better chance of recovery if they're in several different types of groups. So I thought, oh, good, at least I'm in four. You know, there's still a little bit of a chance for me, thank God. And I discovered most of those this year from some of the stuff that I've gone through. And I just, I'm truly grateful to be able to speak tonight and even share my story with people, because I'm not supposed to be here. I'm just not supposed to be here. The pressure that I got in school, if I was drinking, I would have killed myself. It would have been the catalyst that I needed. And I was kind of prided myself on, you know, I want to die, but I don't want to kill myself. You know, it's like I would say, I drink, but I don't do drugs. You know, I was just a little bit better, like a little bit better, my ass. It doesn't matter, you know, because it's just like some people might call me a high-bottom drunk because I was never homeless. Or never lost everything yet. That happened later. I'm not even sure I'm going to tell you about that part. But, you know, I used to live downtown, and I'd look out of my place, and I'd see homeless people walking around Lake Eola, and I'd think them, and they were happier than I was. You know, I was so trapped in my head and so miserable and wanted to die that this jail in my head, the loneliness, the loneliness, the loneliness, it's horrible. And the booze makes it go away. You know, it takes 5, maybe 10 minutes to have a couple shots. The anxiety starts to go. Then after that, I have a couple more. I'm not lonely anymore. There's some part of my brain that shuts off. Alcohol is not a depressant for me. It is an antidepressant. It makes me feel good. I get energized. I want to go out. I want to have fun. I want to do everything with everybody. You know, I see heads going. I know you guys know what I'm talking about. We are wired different. We are just wired different. You know, I've read stuff about it. I haven't retained it all in my head, so I'm not even going to try to quote it. But I hear all kinds of stuff about how alcoholics are wired differently, and it's proven fact stuff, you know. So I'm drinking and doing my thing and getting DUIs and getting pulled over all the time and saying, you know, do you know my dad? And it's just a little town, so of course they knew my dad because it was a little town, you know. It wasn't like my dad was some senator or something. He was just this guy that ran a convenience store. They'd be like, yeah, we know your dad. And they'd be like, you better get home. I remember one time I drove to Orlando from Leesburg with a friend of mine, and I had a Pontiac Fiero. Used to love those. I had three of those, not all at the same time. And I had the very first year, 1984, when I had fire problems, and we were on our way back from Orlando, and I was too drunk to drive, so my friend John was driving. And John's like bashing me in the arm, trying to wake me up. And he's like, dude, wake up. And I'm like, what's wrong? He goes, the engine's on fire. Look. And he's on an off ramp, you know. And I'm like, well, pull over, you know. What do you think, you know? The whole engine just caught on fire while I was driving. I don't know how we continued to go. It didn't blow up or anything, but it was on fire. We pulled over. And I don't even remember what happened after that. I was just, you know, I was passed out drunk. I think the car got towed or came back and got it the next day or whatever. Of course, I ended up buying two more of those later on because I loved it so much. So I started working for Disney in 1990, and a few years before that, I was working for Marriott. I was working at the Marriott Orlando World Center. It was their flagship resort, and I was working in food and beverage, and they had seven different restaurants and bars there, and I got to work in the fine dining room. So I got to learn all about the wines, and it was great because back then we'd make $150, $200 a night in tips, and we'd go out every single night and go to the Laughing Kookaburra Lounge and blow every single bit of it, you know, and it was great because I had all this money, cash, right in my hand that I could spend immediately. I didn't have to wait for a paycheck. I didn't have to write checks. I didn't need credit cards. It was great. So started working for Marriott, and I switched over to working for Disney. Started in entertainment. I went to a dance audition there for entertainment, and I suck horribly at dancing. So after I got done, they said, yeah, we're going to hire you, but you're going to be a toy soldier in the Christmas parade because we just need four guys that'll fit the costumes. So I was one of those guys that fit the costume. So I kind of snuck in to that. And the reason that I went to go work for Disney and did that is because I was in a relationship with somebody that I was in a relationship for about a month, and they decided they wanted to date someone else after they had moved in with me. I'm like a lesbian. If you have sex with me, you move in with me immediately. You're welcome, honey. So I know they have, you have U-Hauls on standby when you go on dates. I've heard every bit of it. I've heard every bit of it.
She has her own truck, ladies. Just FYI.
My sponsor is not here, and I'm going to be in so much trouble. It's not even funny. He texted me before I came, and he goes, put away the note cards and everything else. Just show up and speak, you know, through God. And I'm like, don't worry. I know it's not the At All But Show. It's an A speaker thing, you know, and now he's going to hear all this crap, and I'm going to be yelled at. So I'm in this relationship with this person for a month, and which is real healthy to move in with somebody after a month of just getting to know them, especially when I'm sure I met them drunk. They decided they wanted to be with somebody else and just disappeared for a week. Didn't call me, didn't tell me where they were, just left. I was unbelievably devastated. This is where I started to realize that I can't live without somebody else. And I need the alcohol in order to get me to be able to talk to other people to get rid of the loneliness. So I'm ready to die. I'm breaking down. None of my friends know I'm gay. I'm losing my mind. And I find out that the person that they started dating is in entertainment at Disney. So what do? Naturally, I go to an entertainment audition because, you know, I have to be like this other person. I started working for Walt Disney World, and after a couple of months, they made me perm, which is what they call permanent employee. I went from casual temporary to a permanent employee. And at Disney, they categorize you by height for what you do in entertainment. So I was Pluto height. So I would do Pluto, Tigger, Eeyore, those types of characters. And I did the area in the Magic Kingdom. So I would walk around in these costumes all the time. And you don't know what hell is until you have a hangover where all you want to do is throw up and you're in a Pluto costume, rebreathing, heated air, your eyes are fogging up, you've got 20 more minutes to walk around and greet small children, and all you want to do is vomit. And I mean vomit. Oh my God, one time I told this story to a couple of my friends the other day in group therapy.
That's where my best friends come from, group therapy.
And I told them I was in Pluto, but I didn't mention that I had a hangover when I told them this story. This little boy, because I'm going through this inner child workshop where we're learning all about how the children we should have been are today and why we're da la 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 la. It's great. It really is good. I make it sound funny, but it's great. So anyway, we're to this point, we're talking about preschoolers, and I'm telling the story about me being in Pluto, and I'm in my costume, and this little boy comes up to me. He just started to realize the difference between boys and girls. So he takes his fist and pulls back as hard as he can, and he punches me right where he knows I'm different from girls. And I was just like, oh! And you're not allowed to talk in these costumes. It is forbidden against the law. You are terminated instantly if you talk. He pulled back again to do it, and I grabbed his hand and I pulled him right up to my mouth. I pulled him right up to my mouth, and I went, "Where is your mother?" And he was like, "Ah!" And he took off, and I know he's in therapy somewhere now. But I was so hungover that day. I mean, I'm in Pluto. I'm way over here in the shade, up against the wall like this. I'm not even moving. People are coming over and taking pictures, and I'm just like this. And this kid comes up to me and goes, "Boom!" Well, then I became a show character. That used to be called MGM Studios, and when I became a show character, I became the sheepdog at the end of The Voyage of the Little Mermaid. Oh, by the way, what you hear in the room stays in the rooms. We're not supposed to tell people what characters we portray at Walt Disney World, so keep it on the down low. Being recorded on two iPhones simultaneously. So I was the big sheepdog at the end of The Voyage of the Little Mermaid. I was Michelangelo from Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. A hangover with 60 pounds of shell on, doing ninja kicks and nunchucks. These guys that I hung around with, we would drink and do these. We would be Donatello's out there, Raphael. I've got the nunchucks spinning them around. I'm supposed to pretend I'm making phone calls for pizza up on stage. You know, and we were all hungover. We used to throw up in our heads all the time. Seriously, really, we would throw up in our heads. And you'd go to the back and you'd go, "I just got sick from heat exhaustion." Lie. Full-blown hangover, you know. My heat exhaustion always smells like beer vomit in my ninja head. So then we would go home for the rest of the day and try to get it together so I could go out and drink again that night. Because that's all I knew how to do. It's all I knew how to do. And I'll tell you, I am really fortunate that I got to work for Walt Disney World, because I didn't know how to make friends and I didn't know how to connect with other people. And that company allowed me to work with a cast of four or five people where I actually got to get close to some people a little bit. Actually, one of the coolest jobs was the Toy Soldiers. I don't know if you've ever seen them before, but there's like 24 of them, 36 of them. They're on Main Street. They go down through the Christmas parade. They get televised. You got to learn how to do formation and stuff. And I never did organized sports, but So I never understood the camaraderie that you have for being in sports and working with other people in sports. But when I did this and I had to learn how to do formations and everything with these guys, I finally understood what it was like to do that and that camaraderie that you can get and how you can feel close to other people without being close to them and feeling a part of. That entertainment was a fantastic job for me. I really enjoyed it. I know it doesn't sound like it this second, but I get really nervous coming up and talking in front of people like this because I'm talking about me. I don't have a problem getting up in front of 500, 600 people or being televised to a million people, you know, because I got a Pluto head on. You can't see me. You don't know who I am. I'm portraying someone else. But coming up here and talking or my singing, I'm showing my soul and I'm bearing what's inside of me and how I feel. And I'm always afraid people are going to see the loneliness or they're going to see that I'm not worth being friends with or hanging around with. And it's still something that I struggle with now. And it's sad. It's not just sad for me. It's sad for anybody in here. It's sad for anybody that struggles with drinking. I think it's to me, it's the common denominator I've seen with everyone I've ever sponsored, any sponsors I've ever worked with before. And the isolation that comes with it, and being trapped in your head. You know, I went to go visit my mother today, and she doesn't walk anymore, and right now she's in the hospital again. She can barely pick up a cup to drink water. And she said to me today, she said, it makes me so happy when you come see me. And they didn't say that when I was in high school and college. I made them worry, just like anybody in here that's had kids or you've been a kid to somebody, you made your relatives worry. They go, where are you going? What are you doing? And you're like, hey, I'm my own person. Leave me alone. Get lost. You don't know what's going on. You know? Now I understand that. You know? I understand all of that. I think even though there's millions and millions of people that have this disease that are in this program, it's so misunderstood. And all kinds of mental illness is so misunderstood. It's a sad state, you know. But anyway, you know a little bit about Disney. And I figured I'd keep doing that because it was the only way I could stay connected to the person I was dating. And then I got a crush on somebody else, and they were in AA. So I thought, what better way to get close to them, but to start going to AA meetings because we'll have a little bit of commonality and then maybe I can get in your pants. So the other thing that I never realized, it took a while, is that I didn't really care about the sex. I confuse sex with love. And love is the thing that makes me feel not lonely. So that's why I fall in love in a month and move in with somebody. And I will do anything possible to try to connect to you, like going to an AA meeting, so I can have some commonality with you, so that we'll have something to talk about, so that maybe by chance you will fall in love with me and I won't be alone anymore. So I went to AA. One of my friends, I went with somebody that had admittedly said that they had gone, and they took me to my first AA meeting, and it was a gay AA meeting. And I was so pissed off because he didn't tell me that, and I didn't have on the right clothes. So that was my big concern. I wasn't dressed properly for an AA meeting. And tonight I dressed up out of respect for the program, but also because I don't get to dress up very much anymore. So I went to AA for the wrong reasons, but I don't know why. I kept going back, and I kept going back, and somehow I got snuck in through the back door, and I was sober for 12 years, and I had had maybe one relationship at that time. And when I got sober in 19, 95, I started to replace that a little bit with food, but also simultaneously, I had busted my knee on stage as Michelangelo, and I had to have reconstructive surgery on it. And I didn't walk for 11 months, and I was on prednisone, which is a steroid, which makes you blow up, and I gained 85 pounds, and I was on painkillers, and I discovered Ben & Jerry's chocolate chip cookie dough ice cream with magic shell was fantastic after every meal when I was on painkillers, recuperating on the couch for 11 months. And I gained 85 pounds, and then after that, it didn't stop, and I just kept getting fatter and fatter and fatter, and I used to weigh over 300 pounds. So I'm 300 pounds, and in the program, and somebody was paying attention to me, and I, of course, fell in love with them and was devastated over this. And then I ended up losing the weight. I tried for 10 years to get the weight off, and I couldn't do it on my own. It was just too difficult. I actually had bypass surgery, and I started to lose the weight. And I'm going to tell you a part right now that's kind of conceited, but I'm going to tell you anyway. It's part of the story. When I was younger, people would always say, oh, you're so funny and you're so good looking. And I used to hear that so much that I just thought that's what people say to people, like, have a nice day. You know, I wasn't invalidating what they were saying. It's just that's what I heard, so it didn't mean anything to me. And then I got fat and people started going, you are so funny. And I was like, what the F happened to the good looking part? You know? So for 10 years, I beat the hell out of myself because I didn't look right, from my peer pressure, from the people that I hung around with, and my self-esteem got worse and worse and worse and worse. And I had this surgery, and I got the weight off for health reasons, and also because I just couldn't get it off on my own, and I also thought I'm never, ever going to be able to find anybody if I don't get this weight off. And so I had the bypass surgery and lost way over 100 pounds. And somebody started to pay attention to me, and they were a newcomer in the rooms. And I thought, this is the only chance I will ever have to get somebody again. So I started messing around with them. And before long, it was a very unhealthy relationship that should have never happened. But 6 months into it, we're living together, because naturally we move in together. And he's doing all kinds of drugs. And I hope to God he's alive somewhere out there someday. Today. But it became very unhealthy, and I ended up relapsing. And the very first night that I relapsed, I had not drank in 12 years. And when you have bypass surgery, they tell you don't drink at all because you process it much quicker and faster and different. So within 6 hours, I was in a blackout. And a couple days later, and Nelson, I know you've heard the story 100 times, so just bear with me. Within 6 hours, I was in a blackout, and you know how a couple days later you start piecing stuff together? Well, I'm like, what were we doing in the kitchen with butcher knives? And he goes, oh, that's a funny story. He says, we were both really depressed and said that we didn't want to live anymore, so we were going to slice each other's throats. And I said, that's why I was standing behind you with a butcher knife up to your neck? I was in a blackout. I mean, and this is how sick and screwed up I was. I was so selfish and self-centered, I was like, what if I sliced your throat and you had died and you couldn't get to me? I'd have gone to jail for that. They don't let you offer that. I mean, this is how self-centered and selfish and screwed up I was after 12 years of sobriety, because I was so, I got to have somebody to love me because I'm so alone. You know, I had a halfway decent program, you know, but this past 6 years has been phenomenal. It's been much, much better. But it's also allowed me to realize some other defects that I have, like this problem with feeling I need someone else. You know, you can call it codependency, you can call it whatever you want to call it. But I've realized it especially this past year, because last year I was fortunate enough to have a very healthy relationship with somebody. But about 6 months into it, I started turning into my old self and didn't have the tools necessary to continue a proper relationship, and I started to push the person away. And see, my thing is, if I push you away and I push hard enough and I crap on you bad enough, if you stay, you must really love me. Guess what healthy people do? They don't stay with you. They go away. And that's what happened. And so when that happened, it devastated me yet again. When I relapsed after 12 years and I had a butcher knife up to my neck, up to somebody else's neck, I was trying to kill myself, and within a week overdosed on pills because I was all screwed up and couldn't handle it anymore. I almost died again. That's what I did that time. This time, what I did was I dove into the program harder than I've ever dove into it before. I was up in the morning with anxiety that I couldn't sleep for what was going on, and I was here at 6:30 in the morning at meetings. I was talking to 3 and 4 different people a day. I was going to a meeting in the evening. I was planning my day around a meeting. I was praying to God. I was reading stuff. I was doing every single thing I was supposed to do. And I've gotten a lot better for it, but it just made me realize there's a lot of stuff I need to work on. And just like it says in the big book, there's outside problems that we have. Sometimes you need to seek outside help, which I've done. This is a phenomenal program. It's changed my life. I'm lucky to be here because of it. But I also take the other things that it says in the big book seriously, like seeking outside help and talking to other people and being able to do the things that I need to do to become a better person. I sponsor people. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor, and they've all worked the steps. That's important. I see people sponsoring people that haven't walked through the steps. I see people coming here that just want to show up at meetings, and that's okay. Hopefully it will stick a little bit more, and you'll want to come back in, you know, but you can't go to the doctor's office and sit in the waiting room, you know? If you're sick, you got to go and see the doctor. Then you got to get the prescription. Then you got to do what he tells you to do. Then you got to follow up, and you got to keep doing it till you get better. Well, guess what? This is the same thing. This is the waiting room. So you got to come in here, and now you got to see the doctor, and you got to get a sponsor, and you got to do what you're supposed to do, or otherwise you're going to end up in the kitchen with a butcher knife up to somebody's neck. And you don't think it's going to happen to you, but guess what? It could happen. It could happen in 6 hours in a blackout, and you don't even know what you're doing. You know? I can't even imagine what it would be like to wake up in a jail cell and find out that I had sliced somebody's throat. Now, I woke up in a bunch of jail cells before. You know, the 33rd Street Resort and Spa. I used to go there. I can remember a couple times I'd wake up out of a blackout. They'd have me face down next to the drain in the middle of the cell because they didn't want me to choke on my own vomit because it'd be too much paperwork. So that's the way I would wake up. And that only happened a couple times. like there's some badge of honor or something. I've learned how to do a lot of things differently now. And the thing that stands out in my mind now is that, you know, back when I used to drink and not care about anybody but myself, I could care less that my mother couldn't walk, and I could care less that my dad was taking care of her. And I would get really pissed off when she would take her cane and she would bang it against the wall in her bedroom and scream, Eddie, come help me go to the bathroom. I was like, God, I'm exhausted, I'm tired. She needs somebody to help her get up and get out of bed to go to the bathroom. You know, now I go sit with her for 4 hours while she's sleeping in the hospital next to her bed with holding her hand, you know, just so that when she wakes up, she can turn to me and go, I'm so happy when you come see me. You know? She's at the end of her life now, and she gets her joy from her children. And if I don't get better, she's going to die, and she's not going to have her life fulfilled. Because when you have children, you want to see them succeed and do better than you. And man, does she smile when I go in there. She smiles big. It took a long time to train her to do this, but she calls me her favorite son now. I used to tell her all the time, I'm your favorite, aren't you? And she'd go, no, I don't have any favorites. Go, yes, you do. I'm your favorite. I'm not. So now I call, my dad goes, hang on, I'll let you talk to your mother. Goes, guess who it is? It's your favorite son. And I get the phone. You know, I've gone through the steps a few times and done a few things and with my parents. And, you know, funny how every time I get around to doing like an eighth step, I can remember years ago, I remember calling one time and going, hey, Dad, you know, I was wondering if I could come up and talk to you and Mom for a little while. And I wanted to tell you something, you know, because I was going to do an amends thing with him. And he'd go, eighth and ninth step, huh? Hang on a second, I'll put your mom on the phone. And I'm like, no, wait. And he goes, Phyllis, Eddie's on the phone. He's got to do an eighth and ninth step. And they'd get on the phone. And I'd be like, well, I want to come up and talk to you guys. And my dad's like, no, it's okay. We know, you used to drink, you relapsed, you're better now. How's the car? Is the car okay? Is there oil in it? Okay, great. All right, I'll just talk to your mother. Boom. So, that's the guy that used to say to me, I know what you are. I know what you are. And I don't like it. And you need to burn in hell for that kind of stuff. Now, he's done a complete 360, and it has nothing to do with that stuff I was talking about earlier. I'm just a better person from AA. Doesn't matter what I am, as far as sexuality or color of my skin, or if I'm Ukrainian, I'm Ukrainian. All they care about is that I suit up and I show up and I do the deal now. You know, and I know I got to finish. I got to tell the iPhone story.
Oh, yes, please.
It's hilarious to me. You guys aren't even going to laugh, but I'm still going to tell you. So I'm sharing a meeting with somebody and I'm flying to the meeting. Laura's back there. She's like, can you share Thursday nights with me because I can't make it all the time and it would help. And I'm like, sure. So I'm like texting her. I'm like, I'm on my way. She's like, okay, I'll set up for you. And I come flying in and she's sitting here and it is like 60 seconds. And I'm like, damn, I made it through traffic and everything. And I sit down and I start doing the whole thing. And I do the story and I look down at the counter and I go, oh my God, I left my phone in the car and I was rushing in here so quick. I know I left that thing unlocked. And it's right out front. And I'm like, you know, my technology, I got to have it. So I'm like, I'm thinking, it'll be fine. After the meeting, I go out there, phone's gone. I am so mad. I'm like, at Central? Really? It's like stealing it right out of a church parking lot, you know? I was so mad. I'm like, it's okay, it's cool, I'm fine, I'm all right. I need to upgrade anyway, I'll just go to Verizon. So I drive to Verizon, and I'm telling them how my phone just got stolen out of my car, and I am furious. And I thought, wait a minute, you guys. Hey, can I use one of your tablets? I got that iPhone app, Find Your iPhone. And they go, sure. I go over, and I plug it in. There goes my iPhone. I see it. It is flying up I-4 to Lake Mary. I am like, no, I can't believe this. Somebody took it out of my car, and they've got the nerve. So I start texting right from the pad to the phone. You turn my iPhone right now, no questions asked, $100, I'll give it to you. And I just keep doing it over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. And I go over and I'm talking to the people, and they're like, the Verizon people are thrilled. They're like, you can see your phone going all over Orlando? And I'm like, yeah, it's going to Lake Mary right now, and all this other stuff. So then I'm talking to them, and I'm thinking, well, I'm going to have to get a phone anyway. They're not going to come back and give me the phone. And I go back over to the tablet, and I see it, and the phone's coming back down I-4. And the phone pulls up right to the spot where my car was. And I'm thinking, the iPhone, then I see the iPhone come around the side of the building into this parking lot. They make a left. They go up this street. And I leave two blocks away, and I see it. And I'm like, oh, my God. They've got my iPhone case has got my driver's license and my credit card and my address and everything in it. So they're going to my house to rob my ass. So I jump on the phone and call the police, and I'm calling 911, and I'm going, I'm about to be robbed. And they're like, what do you mean you're about to be robbed? And I'm like, I got my iPhone on the iPad, and they're going to my house, and they're going to steal. They're pulling in the driveway right now. And I'm trying to call my roommate or my housemate. He owns the house downstairs, but I have the apartment upstairs. And I get him, and I go, Sean, somebody's pulling up the driveway right now, and I don't know what's going to happen. He's like, Ed, I've got your iPhone. I go, what do you mean you got my iPhone? He goes, yeah, Laura called me. She picked it up accidentally when you swapped out at the meeting. She said, and she took it, drove it to Lake Mary and kept hearing the beeping going off in her purse, so she drove it back here, and I watched her hand it off to him, go to the parking lot, and drive back to the house. So I'm like, I just want to let you know that the police are on the way. I had to get the story in, Laura. And I have many more, but maybe next year. Thank you so much for letting me share. Stay sober.